Hey, you are listening to The Workplace Theatre. This is the podcast where we go behind the scenes of corporate real estate, talking to industry experts about how they shape the next generation workplace. I'm your host, Sabine M., and in today's episode, I'm speaking with Rob Blair. Rob is Senior Workplace Manager for Region EMEA at Sprinklr. Hi, everyone. Today, I'm talking to Rob Blair. We met a couple of weeks ago at a panel discussion in the green room, and we were waiting there for the panel to start. And we're kind of joking about snacks missing at that opportunity because we were, of course, remotely. And that's how we connected. And I found that he had some really good points to share afterwards in the discussion. And that's why I invited him to join me today. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Sabine. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Let's start right away. You work for Sprinklr. Can you tell me and the audience what your role there is and what Sprinklr does?
Sure. So Sprinklr is a enterprise SaaS platform, so software as a service, and its main goal is to we help big brands listen and interact with their customers. Our mission at Sprinklr is to enable every organization on the planet to make their customers happier. We work with 9 out of the top 10 most valuable brands in the world. We're currently in a hyper-growth mode as a business, so we're experiencing a lot of kind of growth globally and as we scale. My role within the business is a senior workplace manager. So we have a team of about 6 people right now globally, and we are growing fast within the business right now. So we only have 6 people right now. I'm actually recruiting 4 people in my, I look after the Europe and Middle East is my region. So we're recruiting 4 people currently right now. So in London, Paris, Dubai, and Hamburg. So we are growing the team rapidly as we prepare for a return to office.
So if somebody feels they want to join, they should reach out to you.
Absolutely. Our careers page is live. We have the 4 open roles there. So please do apply.
That's cool. Now, how big is Sprinklr's real estate portfolio?
So we have 25 offices globally with headquarters in our global headquarters in New York, but our kind of main hubs are in New York, London and Singapore. I don't have it in terms of a square footage, but we are about 2,500 employees globally. And we're on track to probably reach 3,500 by about the end of this year. So it's a rapid growth we're in at the moment.
How did you end up as senior workplace manager? What's your professional background?
That's really interesting. I went from school, got my A-levels, and then went off to university like a good kind of student, and then actually found out I didn't really like it. And so I dropped out of that, and I always was good with people. I'm an empath at heart, so I was always connected well with other people. So I ended up kind of falling into the hospitality trade, and then I proceeded to work in hotel management, sort of front of house end for about 9 years, and that was very good to me. I worked in the kind of high-end luxury level and was able to take that across the world. I worked in Canada, in Australia, but mostly locally to me, just outside of London. And then having the last kind of stints I had was in Australia, and I just moved back to the UK, and I was tired of the kind of UK particular's opinion of hospitality trade. I think it was not very well respected in terms of the effort and commitment that goes into that. I don't think it's, I'm not sure that's the case anywhere in the world, to be honest, but I think particularly in the UK. And so I was looking to see what I could do to use the skills that I had. Long story short, through some conversation with friends and some recommendations, I ended up getting my first kind of role as an office manager, and then progressed sort of through office management, ended up in the flexible work sector, flexible real estate. And then it's kind of scaled from there through various flexible workspace providers, taking a more kind of strategic role in commercial real estate, and now to where I am at Sprinklr in the kind of workplace role and overseeing our commercial real estate in the region we have at Sprinklr. In my region, I have 10 offices, over 600 people. So it's been quite a journey for me.
What I find interesting about the world of workplace management is that there is not really an education to get there. I mean, there is, but a lot of people come in having the experience from other sectors, the necessary empathy and these kind of things, and looking at things in an overarching manner. So that's quite fascinating, I'd say.
Yeah, I think even now, as I'm actively recruiting people, I think I'd say a strong percentage of the people that I speak to say, oh, well, I fell into office management or I fell into workplace management. You know, there never seems to be a kind of a well-trodden career path. But the one thing I would say is I do feel very, very fortunate that, and I'm sure we'll come across to cover this a bit later in the podcast, but the kind of shift, particularly in workplace and the focus on hospitality and employee and experience around that, I think now that that's been given such an increased focus, I do feel very privileged and grateful for the hospitality background that I have, because those skills are more relatable now than even when I started in kind of workplace, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, when it certainly wasn't a bad thing to have, but it was certainly not given the credibility that it maybe is now. And not even that long, not even that much time has passed since that. In the last 8 years, a lot has changed. So.
Yeah, that's so true. A lot of workplace designers are looking to the hospitality sector now for inspiration as to what can be done. Should we work with scents, music? How do we get visitors inside? And what should the experience be? So I'm really curious on your thoughts for that later. I imagine with the corporate real estate team being as small as it is currently, you rather have flat hierarchies.
Yeah. So, I mean, the EMEA team right now is just me. I had one or two people kind of helping me out over the past year, but essentially we are, because we've not been in offices for over a year now as a business, we've not needed to have quite so many hands on deck. And obviously we're scaling up to revamp towards that. So the last year for us has looked a lot, you know, we put a huge focus on our people and remote engagement. So although that's certainly been quite a job working with the number of people that we have, we've not quite needed as many hands on deck to own that, at least from an EMEA perspective. So yeah, but say the team will globally be more like 14 to 16 in the next kind of 4 or 5 months. So we really are ramping up now as a team. So that'll be exciting.
Yeah. And where does corporate real estate sit within the company? So in which organization does it report?
So we report into finance. So which I think talking to people, especially in interview stage, that kind of can be a little bit unnerving, because I think people, you know, think, oh, well, a lot of the candidates we're talking to have in the last year have maybe lost their jobs, you know, and maybe because they've reported into a finance who have seen them as maybe a cost center rather than an investment. And the way I kind of describe it, at least from our side, is that we have a fantastic relationship with our finance team. They see the value in what we do and what we add to the business. At the end of the day, you know, Sprinklr is a real huge tech company. And, you know, although we don't have the same budgets as a Google or a Facebook, you know, those are our competition in the fight for talent in this world. And so, you know, we although we can't compete with them on a budget sense on the same scale, where we can compete with them is on the benefits we offer as a company, the experience that they have when we do get them into offices and places like that. So where we can kind of interact with them more, and that's where our skill set lies. And very fortunately, our finance team understand that and our position in the fight for the best talent out there, and how we, you know, keep the people that we've got that are already here. So they're very respectful of that, and we're very grateful for their backing.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned it, you acknowledge the fight for talent and that the workplace plays an important role in that. What is the most common workplace configuration that you currently have?
We only have a very, very small number of offices that are actually open within our global portfolio. I'd say the biggest of those is our Singapore headquarters, which we opened a few months ago. And, you know, we are doing that at Sprinklr, we perceive the future of work for us and our business as a kind of hybrid model. And so we certainly have like a space management system where people reserve their desks to come in. We work on a kind of neighborhoods basis. So there will be an area for finance, an area for sales, and that kind of thing. And so our colleagues will need to book that in advance to come in. And that's worked quite successfully. We do have a managed kind of capacity basis. So everything is kind of COVID compliant and the like. But that's kind of how we foresee this going for us as a business. That's from the feedback that we've taken from our people and just what seems to be the best fit for us right now. As I say, it'll be an even bigger game changer when we get some of our other, you know, larger offices back online, like New York and London particularly. But we kind of, you know, we have these neighborhood areas, we have designated quiet areas within the building so that people don't have to necessarily sit within their team if they want to come to work, to avoid the roadworks being done outside their house or the kids that are at home or whatever it is. So there's variety and choice for everyone.
So do I understand that correctly, that the lockdown in this situation right now did not change that much for your company in terms of the workplace?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, we have got plans to make some change to the office, but actually we've not changed that much. We've obviously working on a reduced capacity, which again is slightly different depending on the areas that which are open. The actual layout hasn't really changed that much. We've certainly looked at what technologies we can and tools we can implement that will help enhance the experience for those who can't come in for whatever reason or don't want to come in. So those are areas that we're constantly looking at, but the actual physical bricks and mortar, the walls and stuff that are all there and the desk and situation hasn't actually changed that much.
So we could even say you're kind of ahead of the curve because you have answers to questions that other organizations are probably now being faced with. And one important is, how do you determine space demand with that flexible approach? Do you have a solution to that?
Yeah, I think we've been very fortunate in terms of the type of company we are. And, you know, even pre-COVID, we had quite a lot of flexibility over how we worked as a business. So yeah, in terms of how we've approached or how we plan to approach the return to office in terms of what that kind of looks like in terms of planning that, we've taken an approach where we interviewed or surveyed our executive leadership team, so the highest level of leadership, and kind of understood what their wants and requirements are as a team. For the senior leadership team, which is obviously the tier just below them, we then interviewed the senior leadership team to understand how they then perceive working with their teams. And then we'll receive the kind of survey, the kind of general population. So it's a kind of tiered system. So because there's no point in us, I don't think, we didn't see it adding value that we would, you know, ask everyone in the business quite how they wanted to work. And, you know, maybe one team will say, oh, well, you know, we want to all work from home all the time, when the senior leader or the executive leader of that team actually wants something completely different, and how he perceives leading that team moving forwards. And that we perceive that would maybe provide us just with more challenges than solutions. So it's we've managed this kind of tiered system where we'll do our executive leadership, find their wants and needs, then down to the senior leadership, and then down to sort of general population. And of course, everyone's opinions will be considered, and we'll do what we can to accommodate all. But at the same time, we need to partner with those leaders and understand how they want to lead their team, because, you know, we don't pretend to know what everyone wants and how everyone wants to work, and the way that, you know, we don't sort of pretend to understand that ourselves. So we partner with them to understand their needs and sort of work backwards from there.
With new options out there for a lot of people, we do have to understand for ourselves how we do like to work and how we can be most productive and what helps us best to collaborate with colleagues. So it's a new question for everyone. That means as well, you have a broad base kind of employee survey or something that you're doing.
Yeah, that's right. So again, it's like most good surveys, I think, you know, similar to like an NPS score, for example, the key is in the verbatim and the feedback that we get. We can ask as many kind of closed questions or as many yes or no questions as we like, but actually getting the actual data and the feedback in and context and color behind the decisions of why they've answered that way is the most important thing. So yeah, again, the tiered system has been the best approach for us. So we don't necessarily go out and ask everyone in the population a question about how they want to work in general terms, when we know that the leader wants to work in a certain way, so we can kind of tap into that and understand what's the best way that we can all work together as a kind of global team. And I think a lot of what this is every organization really needs to come up with their own definition of what hybrid working is, because the term is thrown out around quite a lot right now. And we interpret the hybrid working to be to differ from team to team, from office to office. We have one team in the US, which, you know, the leader, you know, wants their team to be in the office 4 days a week at a minimum, because that's the way he perceives the best way to run his team. And so, but in that same team equivalent in the UK works very differently. So it's about understanding what it means to each team, what it means to each office, and then kind of going out, defining that and understanding what's the best way to move forwards on that basis.
And then being able to iterate on that, I guess, putting something out, defining an option that's worth to try, and then considering that still as reversible.
Absolutely. The way I personally see a return to office on a kind of wider scale is that it's a series of kind of micro experiments. And, you know, some stuff is going to work, some stuff's got to not. We've got to be prepared to fail, to capture data, to learn and be able to have this kind of agile approach where we can say, okay, we thought this was going to work, it didn't, let's now pivot and try this. And I think that anyone who's thinking of making any serious investments in workplace should think very carefully about that before they do it and try and build upon what we already have and kind of almost dip the proverbial toe in the water before jumping all in.
Yeah, I think that's a very crucial point, to now not try something that's completely unnatural to you, that you've never done before, but stick with the things that you're good at and move from there. Now, with these micro experiments, are you drawing there on your experience in the hospitality sector? Do you have something you want to try out?
I wouldn't say especially. I think that our focus has always been on our people at Sprinklr, and I think that's just the approach that we've tried to take, as human an approach to this as possible, and that's as best a way I can describe how I would perceive how we approach any kind of return to office. A kind of hybrid model is as much for me a cultural shift as it is a physical one. And again, feel very fortunate that we as a business will have this kind of culture and a level of flexibility anyway. But this hybrid shift requires kind of buy-in from the top down and empowerment from the bottom up. That's how I kind of like to describe it, because there's no point if, for a lot of businesses out there who are thinking of going back hybrid and sort of championing this great new way of working, if the boss is still going to be in Monday to Friday, 9 to 6, and kind of expect all of his team to fit the same way. So, you know, it's a culture shift as much as it is physical. And I think that's going to be a big challenge for a lot of businesses out there. And as I say, very thankful that Sprinklr and the company that we're in has a lot of flexibility anyway. So it's not been such a dramatic shift for us.
Yeah, I do agree on that. I tend to get angry in the meantime if people are sticking to old structures and are feeling that homeworking is a mistake. And my opinion. Everybody can have their opinion. Now, what I wanted to ask is, do you have, for that hybrid work or so return to work, certain tools and processes that you put in place or have in place already?
Sure. I think the easy ones for us, for sure, they'll 100% be a kind of space management platform, let's call it. So like equivalent of a desk reservation system, some sort of symptom checker or waiver to agree before you go into the office that you're feeling okay to get there and to be there. You know, we'll look at what we can do in terms of adding any kind of tech that will enhance the experience for people who maybe can't make it to the office. Because at the end of the day, I see this as an inclusivity thing. And you know, maybe there's going to be a huge portion of our global population that won't want to come to office because maybe they have a weakened immune system and there's some associated risk with physically coming into the office. So, you know, why should they have any less of an experience of that meeting room that meeting they're trying to join? You know, why should they have any less of an experience because they can't come to the office? So we'll certainly look at it at whatever technology we have. Again, we've got some great stuff in our office already. We have the cameras that follow the speaker around the room and that kind of stuff, which is all really good. But for example, can the person see the whiteboard and the TV screen at the same time? Can the one advantage or one of the huge advantages of the last year is that whenever we've been able to speak to anybody on this kind of the kind of Zoom screens and all that kind of stuff is that we get to see everyone's full face front and center. And, you know, when you're in a conference room, you only get to see that person who sat right in front of you. You can't connect on the same way as we have done where, you know, if I want to call now with 30 people, at least I can see all their faces if they've got their camera on, of course. So, you know, it's about like leveling the playing field as best we can for those people who can't be in the office for whatever the reason, whether it's their choice or whether it's not. But we'll look at whatever is out there to help enhance that. But again, we'll be building on top of what we already have rather than looking for wholesale change.
You mentioned before that Sprinklr is in a high growth mode. Would you say that's then also what's mainly driving the real estate strategy, that you need to cater for that high growth in staff and provide workplaces?
Yeah, I think, again, culture is, we have such a strong culture at Sprinklr and it's ingrained into every part of what we are. So our offices play a huge part in that. They are the culture hubs of our business. So I don't really foresee them going away in that sense for any long period of, in terms of a long-term strategy. But certainly with our portfolio, we do have to keep it quite agile and quite lean. You know, we use the flex space market as much as we can until the teams get to a certain point where that's just not suitable and they're not getting the kind of experience that they would want when you sort of get to that team of, I don't know, maybe around 40, 60 people, when suddenly, you know, being out of a serviced office just isn't, or a co-working space or whatever it is, doesn't kind of offer that same level that you would want from your own space. So, you know, we do keep quite a lean portfolio right now. We only have a handful of traditional kind of leased spaces, and the flex market has been a total game changer for us in terms of helping us scale up and offering the flexibility that we need. So, again, do I see us losing offices? No, not really. Potentially maybe scaling down once we've got some data that's helped us analyze how our spaces are being used. Maybe, yeah, for sure. But certainly not in the short term, for sure.
Does it matter to the business if your locations are CBD or rather suburb? Or have you potentially seen a change in that? Because I've heard it from other tech companies like the Facebooks and Googles that people now not having to be in Silicon Valley, they actually think it's quite good because they're saving on commuting time and the rents are lower and potentially the environment's also nicer for them to live in. Do you feel that as well?
We've certainly seen that some areas are growing in terms of, that are outside of the CBD areas. We have traditionally always kept to the most suitable areas for where our people could commute to. So yeah, I don't see why we would be open to those ideas. It's not something we've, all of our major kind of, our major hubs like our Singapore's, New York's and London are all pretty well set for the foreseeable. But, you know, I don't see us opening up a kind of hub and spoke approach right now in terms of having a kind of main hub and then lots of smaller offices dotted around in perhaps commuter towns, things like that. I think that's a great solution personally, but I don't see that as, it's not in our kind of strategy at Sprinklr. But we certainly know that there are areas in Paris, for example, we have a really great central located office, but we know that the eastern part of Paris is a area that's becoming increasingly popular with tech companies, and it's kind of becoming like the East End of London, which became really hot for a period of time and still is right now. So we know that those areas are coming up and we monitor them closely, but we don't have any major plans to kind of shift any of our huge hubs to out of town areas right now. Again, 2 years time, who knows? but right now, not in our immediate plan.
I have to say that I'm also not that sure about this suburban club approach. I have the feeling that if people are not going to the hub, they will find a place that they like to go to. They will find their clubhouse, whether it be their home or the coffee shop around the corner or the park at times. They will find that. And if they want to have collaboration and meet someone, they will also do that. So now I have a couple of colleagues who live in the neighborhood. And when we have a meeting and the weather is nice, we go for a walk and do that. So I think that will work without orchestrating it necessarily.
Yeah, I agree personally, wholly. And, you know, the idea of having the office is that we get people together, right? And so I think we'll always have that major hub. Will we offer our people, you know, flexibility to work at some co-working space or whatever it is for quiet, dedicated work or whatever it is? Then I can see that, just having a general access to whatever it is, a Regus or a WeWork or whatever that space is. We traditionally find that those major providers aren't in the kind of commuter towns. But yeah, I mean, we'll empower people to work how they feel best. But I don't see us having kind of offices really outside of major sort of hubs right now.
With all we've said, how do you get measured? So what are the success metrics? When is the workplace initiatives that you put in place considered successful?
That's a great question. I mean, we have, as a business, we have what we call an EDAP conversation, which is like an employee delight score, which every leader has with their colleagues on a quarterly basis. And that's looked at really closely. So we monitor that. And certainly we obviously welcome any responses in terms of office space. But what success looks like to us is our people being productive. And that's really difficult to measure. We want people to choose to come to the offices when they're open. But we ultimately, we want the people, our team, to be productive and to you kind of set them up for success. So it's a really difficult one to answer. I don't suppose we've not set any physical success metrics. You know, obviously office occupancy would be great in terms of maxing that out when, you know, in terms of whatever capacity limits we set. And we'll certainly be gauging a lot of feedback from our people when they're there. But I think it's not something we've put a lot of focus on in terms of giving sort of direct metrics for that. But it's certainly something worth thinking about. I think it's an interesting point. We've not really got to that as a business right now, I don't think.
Who's involved into the decision-making process for whether you take a new location or you expand or provide certain equipment? Is that all yours or other people that need to sign off on it?
So whenever we're looking to expand, it's inevitably a decision that's driven by a handful of key teams. So certainly if the sales team, I would guess, have identified a new region that we're looking to expand into as a brand new market. So in, for example, the last 6 months, we've looked at places like Taiwan, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Thailand, all are kind of untapped areas for us in terms of having any kind of real estate or physical footprint. So, you know, we get, I'm guessing that's triggered from a sales perspective in the sense that, we're getting a lot of business in this region. Then they would work with our, we call them culture and talent, but like our HR team to figure out what headcount we would need in that region. They work together to get that signed off with the finance team. And then that kind of filters down to us. And so then we work with the local leaders to understand what their needs are from once we've got a physical headcount, which has been approved. We work with the leaders to understand what their needs are from an office perspective, whether we're talking about, you know, just getting someone a co-working membership so they can work from a couple of locations if it's one or two people. Are we talking about a team of four or five, in which case we might need a small office? We have a kind of rough number per head that we would work to in terms of a kind of desk cost. And obviously that would flex depending on the market costs, and it wouldn't just be a kind of arbitrary number, but we would look quite closely to do our due diligence on what that would cost. And then we kind of run that by finance, and then we get that approved. If we're talking about growth of an existing team, then the headcount is driven by, again, sales. They kind of get their account managers in, and then followed by the success teams. And then again, those numbers are worked through with our HR team, signed off by finance. And then we work closely with the individual leaders in those regions to work out what the numbers are and through to a certain point, and then we help accommodate that. And that's a real challenge for us sometimes, because where we have found difficulty as our team is finance have maybe assigned an extra 10 people to X region, but the leader of that region will say, well, yes, we've had 10 people approved, but I know that we're going to be 15 by the end of the year or 20 people. And then we suddenly get into, okay, so how much space do we really need to look for here? And so that's not an easy point. And I suppose that's where the flexible sort of providers come in hand, in that we don't get tied down for any prolonged period of time, and providing that obviously we're only increasing our size, then they're happy to help accommodate us. So it's a constantly moving jigsaw puzzle for us right now. And our processes have certainly got a lot better in the last year. So there's no kind of surprises that have come on board, but it's certainly, it's not always a clear path. It's more a this is a number that we're all comfortable with right now, and we'll review again in 3 or 4 months' time and see how recruitment's going. And there's a lot more smart people than I that work on these projections in our finance and planning teams that calculate these numbers, who help guide us on our kind of journey with it.
I do remember the situation of sitting in between the chairs of a business, like for example, the marketing team, design team, saying, we're growing, we're going to be 100 people by end of the year. And then headquarters saying, no, you're not. There is no budget for you to hire more people. And then you're like, okay, so what shall we do now? The lease is coming off. So it's actually a great thing that these flex options now are existing, because it's rather new on the market. And I guess the bigger corporations tend not to use it yet. There's still a flavor of having your own space and your brand and your name out somewhere.
Yeah. And where we have found a lot of success is in the kind of, I would say, enterprise scale sort of turnkey solutions. The flex providers that are offering large space. You know, we've all seen what's happened with Knotel, where it's obviously not been a great ending, but that kind of model works really well for us as a business, where particularly because a lot of our teams are growing out of these kind of great co-working spaces, and having those on a kind of larger scale, the providers aren't as numerous as they are with the kind of the real kind of startup scale-ups. So we found those providers have got larger space really great for us. And we've got some in Paris and in the US in those type of models, and that's been really successful for us.
Do I assume correctly that the budget for real estate sits with the business or a central function, or do you own it?
So that, again, that's owned by our finance team. So when we're going into a new region, as I say, we have a kind of generic number that we think of as a per head count for like, or a per desk count, I should say. So we base it around that number, and then that number will go up and down depending on whether we're looking in San Francisco or whether we're looking in Bangkok, you know. So, you know, the number will change quite a lot, but that's how we have our kind of generic number and then work up and down from there. Yeah, finance owns that, the number officially.
That does make sense. So you kind of came sideways into workplace management. And in your self-education process towards that role, is there particular sources that you trusted with for advice and information related to corporate real estate in the workplace?
Sure. Well, I think first thing I would say is our team is, although we've all gained a lot of it, our own experience in workplace and commercial real estate over the last kind of 12 years, as you know, depending on who's the team members in our team, I don't see us as having any egos about it or claiming to be experts in any of our fields in that respect. You know, we've always lent on the other resources that we need to make the best decisions for our business. We work with real estate agents especially when we're going into new markets to understand what market rate is and those kind of things. So we've certainly made use of those. We've always opened up to our network. Tony and I, my boss, who's our global head of workplace, we've been fortunate enough to connect with a lot of people in industry, so we lean on them for help. In terms of resources, we've always looked at the sort of data-driven research from the likes of Leisman and Gensler, who are really thorough and expansive, you know, conducting huge surveys to get huge market feedback. So, you know, those have always been a kind of a guide for us as well. So, you know, whether we're reaching out to architects or brokers or workplace strategists, you know, we've never been afraid to ask for help to get the right solution for us as a business. So yeah, we certainly lean on people when we need to.
Now, leaning on your experience from the hospitality sector, what would you say are the main drivers for employee experience in the workplace, or could be the main drivers, imagining the future ideal workplace? What would you like to have there?
So for me, we have some key pillars as a team, and environment is one of those. So making sure that it's clean, it's safe, it's productive, it's inspiring. Hospitality is a huge one of those, you know, like that, I think that kind of goes without saying. But at Sprinklr, we put such a huge focus on our culture, and we have this real desire to create a sense of belonging. And that's not that we needed to back it up with data, but there is so much data that points out that when you feel valued within your business, when you have a good friend in your business, when you've got a best friend within your business, you know, you want to show up for them, and you want to, you know, you have this kind of shared responsibility that, man, I don't want to let my friends down. I don't want to let my team down. So I'm going to put in my best because they're putting in their best, and driving that set of culture and that kind of culture of belonging where you can turn up to work and not be afraid to be yourself. That's the success of Sprinklr as a business, I see. You know, we've put so much focus on our people, and A, bringing in the right people, and B, listening to them, keeping them happy, making them feel like this is a genuine family, which sounds kind of cheesy. And I'm sure there's a million and one businesses that say the same thing, but you know, it's in our kind of code of our core values, you know, that we treat each other like family. So, and that really comes through. And so we, again, are kind of ambassadors or champions of that. And, you know, we're there to make people feel like they belong. And that's how I kind of see the future of work, you know, and the future of employee experience is, you know, inclusiveness, hospitality, feeling of belonging, all of that kind of stuff really feeds into making a great employee experience.
Yeah. I think especially what you said with the sense of belonging, that's with a generational shift becoming somewhere important, because most people are not just seeking an occupation anymore, but they're seeking something that means something to them. And if you care about the people, it automatically means more to you than if you don't, if you're like a lone soldier working away the hours.
I can't think what the stat is, but there's some ridiculously high percentage of kind of millennials and younger who the percentage that they value that either they're making a difference or their company is making a difference in the world. It's something like, it's like over 60% or something that they see that as a real contributing factor to a new employer. So those numbers 10, 15 years ago would have been almost nominal. Whereas now that's the shift of generation. They value it so much that it's, you know, if you're not doing it, then you're missing out, you know.
Exactly. That's exactly the point that gets me mad. And I think, how can you be so short-sighted to ignore that? Because the stuff that you have now might do away with what's given, but future people, future staff who can make a choice might not choose you anymore if you're not respecting that need.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'll come to the closing question. It kind of taps nicely into it. If you could magically solve any workplace or real estate problem, what would it be?
Oh, that's a good question. I suppose I should be giving some lofty, deep answer about maybe corporate social responsibility or sustainability or I don't know, or maybe just being able to fix everyone's aircon complaints in one go. But
do you have these as well?
I'm not sure there's any office in the world that doesn't have that problem. But I think for me personally, I think I've kind of alluded to it a little bit in here, is that, you know, I think it's the empath in me. So, you know, and working in this hybrid model, how do we level the playing field for everyone to have this kind of inclusive experience where they are in the world? You know, everyone's workplace is going to be different. That's how we kind of see the future of work. And they could be working from a co-working space or at home or on the beach for all we know. So it's about, how do we keep them engaged? How do we keep them connected to the company culture despite being so geographically dispersed? And, you know, how do we make not only that, but how do we make that a seamless and frictionless experience? That's what I would love to solve. And I'm sure there's lots of little solutions and stuff that we can work with. But, you know, we also know that everyone's experiencing platform fatigue and, you know, do I want to have an app for this and another app for that and another app for that? So it would be something that whatever we can do to level the playing field for everyone to have this kind of all-round inclusive experience, because this is, I think as Anthony Slumbers said recently, this is a revolution of what's happening in the workplace right now. This has not happened before. Whatever we do go back to, whenever it becomes a norm, will define how we work forever. So this is the time to kind of act is now, and it's ready for redefining, you know, the whole kind of workplace.
Yeah, we're at this crucial turning point where we can shape what the future will look like for a foreseeable time. Really good one. So last one then, who else would you like to hear on the podcast, and would you have a question for him or her?
I mean, I would be remiss if I didn't say my own boss, because he is fantastic, and he is somewhat of a mentor to me. So a particular shout out to Tony Vargas, my boss. But someone who really inspires me is a guy called Eric Kerr. He works at DoorDash. He's quite prevalent across kind of workplace, particularly on the US side, as that's where he's based. But he's always impressed me about his talks about workplace experience and inclusivity. And he's been a long time in his field. He's, you know, he was doing workplace experience before we knew what workplace experiences was, sort of 10, 15 years ago, sort of came through the early years at WeWork and in their exciting time. So I think I would just ask him about what changes he's seen and what inspiration he's drawn from all the different roles that he's been in, and also how he perceives the future of not just big tech companies who've got these big budgets to be able to facilitate, you know, all these kind of amazing experiences for everyone, but for kind of Joe, average Joe SMEs, you know, what can they do to really define their own future of work? Because there'll be a lot more challenges to those type of companies than to tech companies.
Absolutely. One tends to forget that the loud voices don't represent like everyone. There's other sectors who will find very different solutions. Thinking about the public sector, for example, my mom works there and she's not allowed to do home office. So
yeah,
that's a very different thing and question to answer. So that's a good suggestion. Thank you very much, Rob. I enjoyed this very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode of The Workplace Leader, there's more. Go visit our blog and have a look at some of the other topics we have covered. We have just released a study on corporate real estate in Europe that you can download. Or tune into our next episode of The Workplace Leader.